You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Starting with our first speaker of the morning, who is undoubtedly one of the Greenbelt star speakers this year. We're so pleased to have her here in the hothouse. She's got the kind of CV that makes me want to crawl back under my duvet and go back to sleep and apologise for my futile and frivolous existence. Maybe that's just me. She's achieved so much in her life so far. Her expertise is in marine conservation, coal expansion in India, and rainforest destruction. She is the first woman of colour, she's the first person of colour to lead Greenpeace UK, and she's the first woman to lead Greenpeace UK, and I think it's your first visit to Greenbelt, is that right? So can we give her a really big Greenbelt welcome to Areeba Hamid?
Hi everyone, good morning. I was wondering when I was coming here, who's gonna come at 9:30 in the morning and listen to me speak about climate and migration, something not the cheeriest of the topics, shall we say, but it's encouraging to see you all here. Thank you so much for having me. And I hope that as we go on to talk for the next few minutes, there will be times that'll feel not so cheerful, because the story of climate-induced migration and climate breakdown is a serious one, as you all know. But I also hope that during the course of the conversation, we'll actually get to a place which is hopeful, which is about an alternative world and everything in between. So today, I want you to take away, if there are just top lines, is the fact that who moves, who gets left behind, how climate acts as a multiplier and all of that, and why we need to actually prepare for a future that includes these variations, not shy away from it, not get anxious about it. So I want to begin from a few lines from a poet called Wasson Shear. She has this beautiful poem called Home. I've taken some lines, but it's a longish poem, and I encourage you to pursue it fully. But it says, "No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. You only run for the border when you see the whole city running as well. You only leave home when home won't let you stay. I want to go home, but home is the mouth of a shark. Home is the barrel of a gun. No one would leave home unless home chased you to the shore. No one would leave home unless home is a voice in your ear saying, leave, run, now. I don't know what I have become." So when politicians and media outlets talk about immigrants, we are often shown images of borders and dinghies and children and parents and loads of people trying to break in. There's a narrative of scarcity and anxiety. There's a narrative of closing down borders and saving ourselves as if it's a threat that is coming towards us with sheer power, which is going to destroy the culture and fabric of society that we hold so dear and the values that we hold so dear. And I want to say very clearly today that that is not only a false narrative, that is also a dangerous distraction. It is a dangerous distraction because migration that is happening today, because of climate in particular, when somebody crosses a border, it's not an international border that they cross. It's not the oceans that they cross first. They actually first move 20 miles down the road to the next village because the river in the village that they've been on has dried up because of climate change. Or there are floods, such furious floods. We've all been watching the images from Nepal where a glacier melts. The scientists are still determining the exact cause of that furious flash flood. But we know that the glacier melted, which caused these thunderous flash floods that have leapt at everything. And the loss that's happened is not going to force people to move to the next country. It's going to force people to move to the next city and start again. And that is what's happening right now. The reality of climate migration is already here. And I use that term quite as advisedly. There are lots of scholars who actually call it climate-induced migration, because climate breakdown is never just one factor that forces people to move. It's often a multiplier. It's a threat multiplier. I'll come to it in a second. But every year, tens and millions of people are internally displaced by climate impacts. Whether it's in Kenya, where pastoralist families are dealing with arid lands, where the nomadic balance is collapsing, or in Bangladesh, where rising tides are turning drinkable water into salt. They're moving to the nearest city to survive. And this is not new. For 300,000 years, humans have moved. People move. I stand here today as a first-generation immigrant who grew up in India and moved to the UK to pursue something that I was passionate about. Moving in itself is not a problem. And we have moved there as a fundamental adaptation strategy. When we were all pastoralists at one point, human beings, when a river dried up, we moved to the next valley. When something happened to our crops or to our animals, we tried to get to the next village to find another form of employment and income. That is the natural order of things. But as climate breakdown accelerates, migration is often becoming a primary strategy for survival. Movement is not a policy failure. It's an ancient biological rhythm of survival. We've followed rains, we've fled the droughts, and we've looked for earth that could still hold a seed. But what security analysts today called climate breakdown and climate-induced migration is that multiplier threat. It takes pre-existing wounds. So whatever, we've known this for any crisis. If you are a person who's at the margins of mainstream society, or you are structurally disadvantaged, if you're a woman, if you're a person of color, if you're a person of disability, when a crisis happens, chances are that you are worst affected because you're already disadvantaged in dealing with that crisis. And that's exactly what's happening with climate breakdown. It takes pre-existing wounds, poverty, colonial debt, patriarchy, land theft, and cuts them deeper. It multiplies the reason a family packs their lives into a single cloth bag and moves. And where are they moving? They are moving within the countries. The World Bank's groundswell report projects that 216 million people by 2050 will be forced to move within their own national borders. Most of this population is concentrated in sub-Saharan Africa, East Asia, South Asia, and North Africa. Now, the storm is already here. But instead of stopping the system that fuels the storm, the policy response that we have seen from most governments, in particular from the global northern governments, is to actually keep people trapped in these circumstances instead of preparing for it. And I think that is the fundamental problem in the way in which we view at both climate breakdown and migration today. So I want to then talk about who gets left behind, because very often the question of migration is, oh, all these people, they're coming to our borders. I remember Shooter, the story barely a month ago, people from North Africa, they from Morocco, they broke down the borders, they tried to come in. And the way that story was reported in most of media was so much misinformation. They should be really ashamed of it. Not a single person put a foot on mainland Europe. And yet that story was reported as if there are swathes of people, you know, coming down the borders and entering Europe. Not a single person entered Europe. And that we need to think about who moves, but also we need to think about who gets left behind. And this is where I want to talk about how climate change is gendered. We already know there's a lot of evidence that tell us that women, young women in particular, or women in the household, tend to carry climate breakdown's heaviest load. Traditionally, in pastoral societies, women are responsible for securing food, for securing energy, for securing water in a family. Now imagine this person is in Kenya and there is a drought. The river has broken down. The woman of the household, it took her an hour to walk to the river, to come back from the river, carrying the water for the entire family. That job that took an hour now takes 6, simply because there's no water and she must walk longer to get the same amount of water. Young women are pulled out from schools because actually it's better that these young women help with the rest of the family securing food, water, and energy instead of going to school. So climate breakdown is already disproportionately affecting women and young girls. It's often young men when agricultural livelihood collapses, for example, because of climate change, who are sent to the next towns and cities. And women get left behind, caring for children, for the elderly, with the fewer resources, restricted land rights. And in that, when a disaster suddenly strikes, a flash flood, a cyclone, women face higher mortality rates because of traditional roles. They might not be taught how to swim, something as simple as that, or because caregiving responsibilities delay their evacuation, or because social norms, which are quite strict or traditional in that society, favor mobility of male members rather than women in the family. So the story of migration is incomplete if we only talk about those who leave. We must talk about those who cannot move. And some of the academics call it the principle of trapped populations. Migration requires resources. Just even to bribe a guard at the border or to have your legal documents ready or to be able to get in a dinghy and cross the border and have money for food in the new city for a new life, you need to have resources. And think about people in society who don't simply have these resources, and their fate very often is not choosing to move, is to remain trapped in a place where actually there is no support for human life left because there has been a climate breakdown. And it's when these wounds combine is when we leave, and I'm going to say this, you know, the truth is some people, we just leave them to die in that situation. And that is a society where we're becoming if we continue to think about migration as a threat. And this is where I want to bring in the work of Dr. Salimul Haq, who was one of the greatest minds working on this subject, the confluence of climate and migration, for a very long time from Bangladesh. And he suggested a crucial reframing. For decades, international policy has treated migration as a failure of adaptation, a catastrophic last resort. But Dr. Haq turned that logic on its head, and he said, what if migration is a form of adaptation? We've experienced 5 heat waves this summer in London or in the UK. We've thought about sleepless nights. We've thought about cooling temperatures. We've thought about fitting aircons in every house. But actually, adaptation does not stop there. We have to think about how does the world, these populations that are living in less resource-intense areas, how do they survive? And migration is a form of adaptation. Moving from one place to a better place is going to happen. It's inevitable. Yes, we need to stop the roller coaster of fossil fuels that is putting us in the situation in the first place. But we also need to prepare at the same time to deal with the consequences that are coming at us thick and fast. So, and Dr. Haq talked about how that could actually create more economically resilient societies. Because when a family sends somebody to another city to earn an income, they tend to send money back home, which then makes that family be able to afford energy or food or spread that money around, which means that you can create economically resilient societies if you actually accept the migrants coming in through legal routes, through safe routes, and most of all, through dignity. So instead of treating it as a disaster, Dr. Haq proposed the notion of climate-resilient, migrant-friendly towns. So instead of all these conversations we are having about asylum hotels and riots outside them and all kinds of political horse trading, we need to think about how do we actually plan for cities that are migrant-friendly? And instead of unplanned forced displacement, we think about safe, dignity-centered, planned migration as a form of adaptation, as a form of dealing with climate breakdown. Which brings us to the question of who pays for it? That's all well and good. And every, you know, I've lost count how many prime ministers we've had in the last few years in this country. And every single one of them will stand in front of the parliament and say, we've got no money. Their favorite expression is the previous government, they've maxed out the credit card. I don't know who came up with it, but they use it all the time. They've maxed out the credit card. NHS, we've got no money. Climate, we've got no money. My God, migration, let's not even talk about it. That thing is a threat. And I think there is a solution there because, very simple, make the polluters pay. The people who are breaking this down are responsible for paying for what they've done. Shell made, just in 3 months, anybody wants to guess how much profit they made just in 3 months, in the 3 months leading up to June just this year? Good guess. somewhere in between, £9 billion. Because of the war in Iran, and because of actually previous hangover for the war in Ukraine, where energy prices have soared, and they're laughing, the Shell and BPs of the world are laughing all the way to the banks while we are struggling to pay our bills, and people are being forced to migrate because of climate disasters, which are happening because these companies continue to double down on the problem that is making our situation worse. Shell and BP and Exxon and all these companies, they've known about climate change for a very long time. In fact, there is evidence in the US that tells us that ExxonMobil, its scientists knew about climate change much before the US government found out. And what did they do? They used every trick in the book to stop the government from finding out about the science and then pouring money into lobbying efforts so that their business can continue as usual. I've worked on climate for a very long time. And a few years ago, I want to say maybe 5 years ago, I used to think these companies can change. You know, they have the infrastructure, they have the manpower, they have a global presence, they have got technology. They need to have a plan where they retrain their workers, they start to shut down their fossil fuel fields, and they start to invest heavily into green energy. And there's your solution. We've known this for the longest time. Turns out, that's not what they want to do. And there is no use carrying on with the illusion that these companies will change. They will not change. They will not change till they have extracted the last amount of fossil fuels out of the ground at our expense. And the solution to this problem is to regulate them and force them to start changing their business model. It is incompatible with a livable planet. We cannot even burn the fossil fuels we have right now. And these companies are going out and discovering new fossil fuels. They want to drill in the Arctic. They want to, during the heat waves, Shell lobbied for more North Sea oil and gas during the heat waves. So there is absolutely no point in carrying on with the illusion these companies will change. And therefore, we need to treat them like that. And these companies need to pay for the damages that they have caused. And this money needs to go into investing in adaptation measures, one of which is paying for climate-friendly, migrant-friendly towns. There's also a question of inequity here. Very often I'm asked, why do I work on climate? And for me, the answer has never been really about polar bears and tropical rainforests, lovely as they are and passionately as I feel about them. But at the heart of climate change is the question of inequity. It's a question of who has all the power and how are they using the power and how does that affect us all? And the truth is that very few people in the global north have used all the resources and built lots and lots of money for themselves and spend that money very selfishly on themselves. And it's the global south that's paying the price for it, which brings us to the term loss and damage, which is also something that climate campaigners have campaigned for a very long time, to recognize loss and damage at the UN internationally and get the global north countries to pay into that fund so that people in the global south can access those funds. What's happened in Nepal in the last couple of days, or what happened in Pakistan a few years ago, where 2.1 million people were displaced by floods. That is permanent loss. That is permanent damage. That is not adaptation. That is not mitigation, which are the terms that climate campaigners usually talk about. That is permanent loss and damage. And these corporate fossil fuel corporates need to pay up for that loss and damage. The good news is that a couple of years ago at the Conference of Parties, at the International Climate Conference, loss and damage was recognized as a fund. It's an empty bucket right now. Our job is to make companies, to tax companies in national countries and then get countries to pay into that fund so that Global South countries can access them. And then this brings me to really why should we actually feel hopeful given the story that I've just laid out for all of you? The fact that, you know, climate change is coming at us thick and fast. I was reading about the wildfires that Europe experienced this year. And scientists are now saying that our models did not predict the fires that the way that they've been happening. It's because the fires themselves create a microclimate where more clouds go up and fire begets more fire. And the ground, because it's been so dry for days, there's been no rain, it just gets faster and more furious. 10,000 liters of water goes up in smoke. Firefighters are saying that there's smoke coming out of their shoes. That's why it takes them days and days to get control of fire. So it's let's be forgiving. It's natural to sometimes wake up, look at the news and feel that it's really hard to summon hope. And that is real. That is happening. But I do want to remind everybody who cares for this stuff that we have fought battles like this before and won. Just in this country, there was so much good campaigning that happened that ended coal. The last coal power plant shut down a couple of years ago. That at one point, when I started working on coal in 2006, I was told it's never going to happen. Civilizations run on coal. Industrialization has happened because of coal. Never going to happen. You are an idiot for thinking that economies can get off coal. And it has happened. I think Bill McKibben spoke yesterday. I don't know how many of you attended his talk, but he has a very beautiful phrase. He says, the cheapest way of making electricity in the world right now is to point a piece of glass towards the sun. That's where we are. And that's a massive win. And we forget about that. We forget that we ended fracking in this country despite so much effort. Remember Liz Truss? Somebody, when she tried to bring back fracking, she was sent packing. A piece of lettuce survived her longer. We can do this. We have done this before. Right now, the fight is about the North Sea oil and gas. And again, I think there's an entire movement, not just Greenpeace, lawyers, communities really saying, this is not going to create jobs. This is not going to bring down our bills. We don't have to drill for more North Sea oil and gas. What we can do is really double down on renewable energy. Just this week, you can go to a DIY store and buy a plug-in solar panel and put it on a south-facing wall if you have space outside your house. Stuff is changing, and I think we have to remember that, you know, that famous quote that the arc of justice is long, but it bends towards positive hope. It bends towards justice. So I think we need to hold on to that hope, not as a vacuous feeling, but as a practical thing that we can all do. And I think we need to remind ourselves that we have power as individuals as well. We can write to our MPs. MPs, every time I meet them, tell me, oh, I used to hear a lot about climate change from my constituents, but I don't hear about it anymore. So they are listening to you. When you write them a letter, which might be the most boring thing you can do as a campaigner, is to write a letter to your MP. Guess what? They get read. When you go to their surgery and you raise a question about what are you doing about climate change, they are hearing that. That's important. We have that power. Let's use it. Let's make the noise about polluters. Let's name the villains. Climate change fight is a fight. It has, you know, as a campaigner, you want a good story, you want a villain, and you want a hero. And my God, does climate change story have villains. The Shell and BPs are comical villains at this point. They have done everything they can to stop positive action from taking place. They are blind. They don't even care. They've stopped pretending to be green anymore. There was a time briefly in 2020, I want to say before the pandemic, where they thought, you know, if we do enough greenwashing, maybe we can get away with this. They don't even care that about anymore. So let's name them. Every time there is a climate impact, every time there's a heat wave, every time there is energy spike, think about who's making money off it. And it's the Shells and BPs of the world. Let's name them. Let's shame them. We need to legalize migration as climate adaptation, as I said. That is the strategy, to get ready for climate change that is happening right now, the breakdown that's happening right now, instead of leaving people in situations that they cannot deal with. And we need to invest in communities that are both migrant-friendly and climate-friendly. Very often we think, oh, what will, you know, voting for a local council is going to do? It is going to do a lot, because that local councillor, if they have the right ideas, they will actually invest in communities that are climate-resilient, that are migrant-friendly. We can do those things. And I want to end by saying, you know, these things are not divisive. They've been made divisive by a false narrative, by a dangerous narrative. And it is our responsibility to question those things. We cannot care for environment while we abandon the people living on it. That is not the idea of environmental justice that any of us should subscribe to. Just caring for the land without thinking about the people on it is not justice. The storm is already here. How we navigate that storm is up to us. And I think we have the tools to do that. Like I said, we've won before, we can do it again. And I want to end from a quote from my favorite author, Arundhati Roy, who says, another world is not only possible, she's on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing. Thank you.
What would be your kind of number one policy request of government that would be top of the tree for you?
It would be to regulate fossil fuel companies. Why are we allowing them to continue business as usual? It makes no sense. And to continue to not give up on the promise of ending new for oil and gas. I mean, we are on a road to something great, and I can't believe that people are questioning that. But a new policy would be to regulate fossil fuel companies and tax them.
Hi. You spoke about forcing likes of Shell to change. How? It is not a sort of mythical body. It's controlled by, voted on by, for example, shareholders. Is that a way forward? I hardly dare ask, you know, does Greenpeace have shares in Shell? No.
Jesus.
But should perhaps the answer be that more people do so they can exert pressure? Thank you.
Yeah, no, very good question. Sorry, I misunderstood the first bit. Yes, I think it's a mammoth. You cannot do one thing that'll just change it, right? You need everything everywhere all at once to move this giant. There are some people who have done some really good campaigning, and I used to do some shareholder activism as well, where you can actually buy one share and that gives you access to the AGM. You can go to the AGM, ask questions about before their board of directors and make trouble for them. People are still doing that. There's some groups that still do that. And I think that's important. To disrupt them at every stage is really important. But the belly of the beast is the problem that they have said, we want to make maximum money for our shareholders. That's it. That's our job. Our job is to make money for shareholders. Right now, energy prices are high. When they dig for fossil fuel, they're getting a handsome return. So their shareholders don't really care. And I think this is why we need to get other powers to regulate them. So government to regulate them, to force them. And there's a legal system. There's some really interesting legal work happening now on this stuff where actually climate campaigners are suing oil and gas companies for climate damages on behalf of either people who have suffered climate impacts or on the behalf of saying we have signed to the Paris Agreement and Shell's activities are not in compliance with the Paris Agreement. So in Netherlands, Miller Defensie, which is the Dutch version of Friends of the Earth, has sued Shell a couple of times and won and then forced them to relook at their model. But then they are suing them back. So it's a long fight. It's going to be long. It's going to be hard. But I think it's worth it.
I think most of us would agree that fossil fuel, we must move away from fossil fuels. I don't think there's much contention around that. But I think one of the problems that we, in particularly in the global north, but probably everywhere, think about is what kind of choice do we make over our vehicles? Because electric vehicles clearly have also extraordinary problems for the climate. Also for people, the people who mine the minerals, lithium, for the batteries. And also that the fact that the batteries only last about 7 years, so that we're going to be throwing lithium into landfill sites and so on and so forth. Does Greenpeace have a view on that?
So on electric vehicles, yes. I think the basic fundamental principle to understand is that we cannot continue consumption as usual. So switching every petrol and diesel vehicle today with an electric vehicle is not going to solve the problem. I think we have to have a strategy where more people have access to free, easy, accessible public transport so that we reduce our dependence on cars. We have a policy on how we want critical minerals to be used because critical minerals will be used in batteries as the world moves towards electrification. They are going to be used, but we have very strict policies which we want companies to follow when they build either it's computers or phones or electric cars. They should make sure that no human rights violations happened in the extraction of those critical minerals. I think an alternative thing to think about is finding alternative to those minerals in your own country, because that's easier than to control the supply chain. It's not always possible because lithium, but is there an alternative? And I think some of the companies, smaller companies, are thinking about it, not being reliant on that. The US, funnily enough, has a really good recycling program. So instead of actually getting rid of batteries and throwing them away and polluting your local environment, some cities have started a really good recycling program, because we are underestimating how much recycling will help us if we do it systematically, because batteries can be recycled and reused. That is in some way the beauty of it. But we've somehow not caught up. We're still living in that, there's a debate between electrostate and petrostates. So, and we're still living in a petrostate world, trying to move to an electrostate world. And I think we're throwing away things without thinking, this can be fixed, this can be recycled. And I think that's going to happen more and more. So yes, we have a position on both recycling, but also consumption and reducing consumption, because that's not going to help if we don't reduce consumption.
I was just thinking back to the Netherlands. When they exploited the gas fields in the North Sea, they came up with a sovereign wealth fund, which has bankrolled the Netherlands, bankrolled their renewables, bankrolled their tax situation. You made the point around North Sea not being exploited for the UK, but given the experience the Netherlands have had, and Iceland, for example, isn't that a thought?
You mean we should continue to explore the North Sea?
Well, the oil that comes out of the North Sea is only really much used for gas and also for plastics. And most of the people sitting around here are using a plastic-based Cetor. There's plastics used for medical care, etc. It can't be burnt. That's the main point. And it will be mainly an export-based resource. If you look at the geology, the actual oil under there isn't much use for burning. And that's the reason it hasn't been exploited. So if it can be used for pharmaceutical, can be used for healthcare, can be used for alternatives, but not burnt, maybe battery casings, then create a sovereign wealth fund for the UK, which helps the £3 trillion worth of debt, which is just going up. We're 100% GDP over the last 5 years, as you know. The pandemic didn't help. Then we can get ourselves away from where we are with the states, which are at 40 billion or 40 trillion or whatever it is, what Trump's done, whatever he's done. But, you know, the USA is on a cycle. We need to get ourselves off that cycle. We need a way to get away from it.
So the thing about the North Sea is that there's so much misinformation about the North Sea. And we are at a point where there are numbers that the people who want to drill in the North Sea are using to make the case. And then there are numbers that people want to stop the drilling in the North Sea are using. So we are just talking about, oh, it'll create thousands of jobs. And we are saying, no, it won't. Or it has so much oil left. But the reality, the geological reality, despite all the politics, is that there is not enough oil and gas left in the North Sea. The Norwegians actually have more reserves left because they created the wealth fund. They regulated it more. When the UK opened up the North Sea, it has mostly taken away most of the stuff. And this is something that some of the most enthusiastic proponents will have to agree with, that there isn't much. That's a geological fact. We have mostly emptied the North Sea of oil and gas. As to what it's used for, actually, most of the oil is exported. It's sold on an international market. Some of the gas comes into the UK houses, but again, the price is not set by the government. The price is set by whoever can buy it in an open market. So that oil and gas use is still pretty much being used to burn it. But even if we were to use it differently, we're not going to have any better consequences, because there isn't much left. And there is a national wealth fund that this government set up. The previous version of this government, Keir Starmer, set up. Which has just been to actually do exactly that, to put price caps and then to power green energy through that. But it's very nascent stages at the minute.
So the the reason that politicians don't do anything about climate change is because they're bought out by, you know, Shell and BP and stuff. Considering how deeply entrenched fossil fuels are in the political system of basically every country, do you think it's worth exploring alternative political and economic systems? And if no, why not?
Overthrow capitalism, you mean?
Yeah.
We have reached that part of the conversation. It happens inevitably in every conversation about fossil fuels. Let's overthrow capitalism. Sure. I don't know if there is a viable strategy to do that. I mean, I think there are two paths, right? So not to be facetious, but in some ways, I think where at least Greenpeace places itself is working within a broken system. We are working in a broken system, right? We are not saying... So when people say, oh, how did you get to the North Sea and your dinghy, which you used to do an action to stop an oil rig, is made of plastic. Didn't you think that? Gotcha, haha. But the thing is, that criticism is stupid, because, of course, we are living in a world that is controlled by fossil fuels. They are so embedded in our daily lives that pointing out individual use, do I have a choice? Should I manufacture a boat for myself to go out and take action? No, that is not going to happen. That is also not a good use of resources or the money that people give us to run campaigns. So I think we have accepted that we are in the system, and our job is really to push for the biggest change possible using what we have within that system. Because we want more people to have a better life. We want more environment to feel better. That's our vision. I think I am very curious if somebody has a viable plan since Das Kapital to overthrow capitalism. I'm all ears. But I do think that what we can best do is really reduce their power. If you go look at our three-year strategy, which is online, Greenpeace UK's three-year strategy, really one of the ways that we create change is by reducing destructive power. We want to reduce their power over our politicians. We want to reduce these people's power over our daily lives. That's how far we got to by changing the system. And I think democracy acts as a counterbalance if it functions well, if the votes are not bought, if the politicians are not bought. And that's where all of you come in, because we get to then ask these politicians questions. How much money did you take from fossil fuels? What has that got to do with the opposition on North Sea oil and gas? I think that's why free media is so important. That's why our voices are so important.
Thank you for all this good sense. With the exponential rise in AI, do you have a view on the energy consumption of data centers, water consumption? How are we going to approach AI?
Yeah, this is a very active conversation in a lot and lot of circles, environmental circles at Greenpeace, both within Greenpeace UK, but also globally. And I think we are still learning so much about, because I was thinking about this, I was reading about Brick Lane and the data center coming up there. And actually, I really don't understand. Nobody has made a compelling case to me as to why we suddenly need so many data centers. Because they say, oh, it's not just about AI. In response to Zach Polansky's proposal to stop, to put a pause on building data centers, which is what they've done in New York as well, the response from the government just day before yesterday was, oh, that's a horrible idea because we will lose out, because it's not just about AI, it's about our bank accounts and our daily lives. And I was like, but my bank account has been working for 10 years without a data center. Why do I need one suddenly in the middle of London? So I think one is, again, to ask those questions, like, why are we building? Who are they benefiting? They're not benefiting local communities. They don't create any jobs. What is the critical purpose that they're serving? And I think we have to start there. And yeah, we're worried about energy consumption. There is a report by this organization called Foxglove, who are doing some good work on data centers, which says that actually we can veer off our net zero targets if we start building data centers because of the amount of energy they consume. I think the water question is slightly more contested, because now they say that they consume less water and they recycle the water. I need to look at it more closely. But I think, again, for me, it comes back to the question of power. Are we going to give these companies wholesale power to build these monstrosities in the middle of cities, which create no jobs, which consume a lot of energy? Or actually, are we going to regulate them and force them? There's an alternative. You could force them to build it only with green energy. Force them to build solar panels on the data centers so the data centers can power themselves. Force them to create accessible sort of public environment around it. We can do that. If it's an inevitability, first of all, we need to be convinced that it's an inevitability. In some ways, maybe AI is like the internet was. That's the next stage. But I think we need to think very hard. Do we want to give all our power to just seven dudes in America who run everything? Or do we actually want our government to force them to do better? And I think we can force our governments to regulate them. Okay.
Well, sorry, just to say, I'm from the Green Christian stall, which is just sort of next door here, and we have got information about the Stop Rosebank campaign, QR code of how to protest to your MP, ministers, and flyers to take away. So, wasn't a question. That was a bit of promo. Green Christian, Stop Rosebank.
Good promo.
I just wonder if you could change the focus for a little bit. You talked about climate migrant friendly communities, and I appreciate that at the moment they're probably in the home country. If you are envisaging communities like that growing up in the UK, I'd just be interested to understand how we think that might happen. And this is against the background of the area where I live does have a lot of people who have moved into the area, a lot of young men on their own. A lot of people find that actually really quite frightening. And I think that is part of what is fueling the kind of anti-immigrant feeling. So I'm really interested in how we can be prepared and how we can become climate migrant friendly communities. Thank you.
Yes, I think very often some of these solutions are so hyper-local, the problem feels global and really big. And then when you think about the solution, some of these tend to be so hyper-local. So there is a community actually in, I'm not sure where you're from, but I think there is the first climate migration, induced migration has happened in the UK, in Wales, if I'm not wrong, because there was a village that basically there was too much seawater level rise, so they had to move. But I think that this comes back to investing in local communities. And I think austerity has a lot to answer for because those resources were taken away from local councils, you know, educating people, helping them integrate into the communities. What we did, in fact, we turned doctors and NHS and local schools into border control forces. We ceded, you know, requirements from them to say, oh, if you see somebody who's suspicious, report it to the Home Office. And I think that has created this fear and anxiety. I'm not sure if you have reason to feel frightened of those young men that you're referring to, if they've done something. But I think we're already entering this conversation with preconceived notions that something bad is going to happen. And I think we need to start challenging that frame. And I think the other thing is, I'm not saying that bad incidents don't happen. But again, if you look at the data, there are a lot of people who are just local who get up to no good as well. And we often, the media has told us misinformation that, oh, these people are outsiders. They're here to actually destroy our societies. They have done it. Very often, if you look at the data, that's just not true. So I think local investment in local communities, bringing money to the local councils. I mean, Andy Burnham was a mayor, and he's talking a good game about, you know, giving local powers more authority, more resources. I think that is the way to deal with that, to really create a pathway where people feel like they are a part of society instead of being isolated. Because more isolated individuals are, the more anxious, the more scared we are, and then that's where actually we start to doubt each other.
Hi, can I just build on that point? For those of us really unfamiliar with what a climate and migration-friendly city would look like, can you point us toward resources, writers, or just to become familiar with it? Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. There's Dr. Salimul Haq, whose name I can probably, maybe leave it somebody. H-U-Q is his last name, Dr. Haq. And he did, lots and lots of papers, but there is a paper in the Nature magazine just before he passed away, maybe in 2024, where he talks about all these places in sub-Saharan Africa, North Africa, East Asia, what's happening there, and then he proposes solutions about how climate-friendly trams can be created. And essentially, it's a juxtaposition of, if you think about people who are just moving for their livelihoods as well within cities, when they end up in, say, if I give the example of where I grew up in Delhi, there are lots of small towns that border Delhi, and when people are coming to get employment, they get just stuck typically in slums, and 10 people to a room, really bad, you know, no running water, really, really terrible living circumstances. And what he's proposing is that we think about these waves of people coming in and actually install, I mean, basically expand city infrastructure so that these people can be assimilated and plan for it instead of it being unplanned and instead of it being 10 people to a room, crammed, not having access to food or water. And that also creates local jobs, and think about how the economy can actually benefit from these arrivals instead of thinking of them already as an enemy and the fact that, oh, the resources are scarce and they're going to get them. So it's both a sort of a philosophical shift about how we think about migrants, but also thinking about planning for cities, which is, you know, some cities are really doing it already, so at a smaller level. They're thinking about how they will grow in the future, not just because of migration, but because of population increase. So I think we need to integrate migration into that thinking and set up infrastructure, critical infrastructure that will help assimilate people, welcome people.
Over here, Ariba.
As an individual, how can I force large companies and the government to try and make a change?
Great question. You can, I'm not sure if you're voting age yet, but you should write to your local politician and you should speak to them to say, what are you doing about these companies who are going ahead with impunity? We've had 5 heat waves, wildfires, apocalyptic summer. People are saying there might be another heat wave in September. It has broken every record. What are they doing about it? That's a starting point. And don't give up till you get a satisfying answer.
Just to loop back to the previous set of questions, it seems to me that as well as living with an embedded approach to fossil fuels, we live with an even more dangerous and irrefragable addiction to the idea that Britain is a settled community into which people invade. This is complete rubbish. Is there any person here who can honestly say that they have no ancestors who ever migrated into this country and no ancestors who ever migrated out of it? This country is built on migration. Look at the history. It's been coming and going and going and coming. And way back when I was a young person and we gave really good advantage to incoming young people to study here, we built international friendships that were of enormous value to all concerned. So, yes.
Do you want to respond?
No, that's, I mean, I can't do better than that. That's amazing. I agree. To quote Hamilton, the musical, immigrants, we get the job done.
I'm a bit scared to say this. I'm a politician. I was voted in as a Green councillor in May. And get in touch with your councillors, phone them, email them. I get hundreds of emails and I do try and answer them all. And if the same subject keeps coming up and coming up, you try and do something about it if you can. Secondly, this year in our council budget, because every council has no money because the money from government has gone down, the Greens put in to get the budget over the line, we've got climate bonds, £1 million worth of climate bonds to put solar panels on schools and hospitals in the local area. And the local people can invest in the climate bonds and they will then get their money back with interest when the projects are completed. So that's one way of doing local solar panels, solar projects. So get in touch with your councillors and ask them to do it.
Love it. See? I was on to something. You've heard it from the horse's mouth now.
Okay.
Well, people have talked a bit about cities. I live in rural Cumbria, where it's significantly more expensive to get one of the four buses each day to work than driving. I still get the bus for climate reasons. What wisdom do you have for rural communities, particularly really scattered ones, when there's very low government amounts of government money because there aren't many people as well?
I haven't grown up in a rural community, but I have visited loads, both in India and this country, and I was shocked at living in London. You get used to a level of public transport, which is, you know, be like, oh, I'll be out and the 38 will be outside my house and everything's fine. But actually, I was really, really shocked the first time I realized how difficult it's to get basic public transport. I think that there is a case to be made for longer routes. People who have worked on urban transport might know much more about this than rural transport. I've worked on urban public transport. But I think there is a case to be made for either longer routes that actually go on for longer, but there is a frequency because they've been on the route for much longer, or shorter routes so that people finish their shifts very quickly, but there is more frequency. I think people have tried to deal with that in that way. There's a person I know who's actually cobbled together an electric, small electric bus and is running it between communities, just it's self-funded. But the local council has now recognized it. It's in Scotland and they might get some funding from the councillor, but they had money as a community to just fund it. And it was a small bus. It was like a 20-seater, not a massive bus. So I think there are creative options to think about it. We just sometimes, what you want in our leaders is creativity. And I have, like, I do think that, you know, we really need to push them to be creative, to sometimes come up with solutions, especially for our politicians. And they say, we can't have the same network because there are not enough people. Well, let's think about it, think about the problem differently. So I think there are loads and loads of great examples. We just need to come up with them. We just need to put our heads together, speak to the politicians what is possible, and try and fund them.
Thank you. Question for the politicians, really. A few years ago, I was involved in cycle campaigning, and the wisdom at the time was that the most powerful way to contact them was to actually write a physical letter, put a stamp on it and post it. Is that still true, or is it a bit of an outdated idea?
We tend to email mostly MPs, and they also email us back if we write them a letter. But a physical letter sometimes goes a long way. There was a time when I was working on air pollution in London, and it was Sadiq Khan's first term, and we got 100 school kids to write him a letter to say, do something about air pollution. And apparently everybody in his staff talked about it for ages. So there is something to the power of the physical letter. If it's needed, if you have the time, I would encourage it, definitely.
Okay. I don't know about you, but isn't it great hearing someone absolutely at the top of their game delivering their thoughts to Greenbelt? So feel the love. Yeah.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.